Bob Oakes, sitting in for Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Are you hearing a substantive conversation about race in this presidential campaign? In Iowa Monday night, Al Gore and Bill Bradley had their own race conversation. They talked about racial profiling and affirmative action, and mostly they agreed on their positions. The Democratic Party has had a lock on the black and Hispanic vote for years, but George W. Bush aims to change that. Bush is very popular among minorities in Texas. He learned Spanish to serve his Latino constituents, and he's trying the same outreach approach in his presidential campaign. We've also been hearing about personal experience, Bill Bradley's experience on the New York Knicks, Al Gore's experience in the Clinton White House. We've been hearing about the Confederate flag and Al Sharpton, but have we been hearing a conversation about race in America, Connection listeners? What should we be hearing? Are any of the candidates giving us the big picture? 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255 makes the race connection in Campaign 2000. Joining us in the studio this morning is Orlando Patterson, professor of sociology at Harvard and author of Rituals of Blood. Joining us by phone is Eleanor Holmes Norton, congresswoman for the District of Columbia and an advisor to the Gore campaign. Roger Wilkins, who's working with Bill Bradley, will join us shortly. Good morning, Orlando Patterson.
Good morning.
And so let's start right there. What are we hearing? What are we missing in the conversation so far, in the dialogue about race in the campaign?
Well, we're having a conversation about race, certainly. The politics of race is alive and well in this campaign. If anything, it may be too alive and well. There is a danger, in fact, in overplaying race. And that became evident recently with the problems which Hillary Clinton had at the Martin Luther King event she attended at Al Sharpton. So the question isn't whether race is there and people are talking about race. The question is, how are they talking about it? And how are they treating the issue? And that's my concern. Essentially, is it just politics as usual, in which we have a traditional 20th century approach in which African Americans are seen as a homogeneous group, in which their leaders are solicited to give standard, sort of stock views about the black American, in which one set of interests are assumed to be typical of Afro-Americans, namely the problems of race. That's what I'm seeing, and essentially all the candidates are playing this game, and that's what concerns me.
Because on both sides, Republican and Democrat?
On both sides. I don't see Bush being any different. He's learned his Spanish and so on, but he's doing the same thing. He's assuming that there's a consistency out there called Latinos, and that you meet with a few leaders, you talk to them. The point is, there's no single Latina constituency. There's a world of difference between Cuban Americans, who are very conservative and have one set sort of standard issue having to do with Cuba and communism, and Puerto Rican Americans, who are sort of very different in appearance, in the set of interests they have having to do with unemployment and so on. Similarly, there's a wide range of difference between various groups of Afro-Americans, middle-class Atlantans on the one hand, who are committed to a certain sort of very sort of voluntary segregated pattern of life, Northeastern bourgeois Americans, California African Americans, very, very different. What disturbs me is that I see what we call a traditional civil rights model being still applied. And that accounts for the errors being made in the sense that not all Afro-American problems are race problems. Some of them are. Issues such as racial profiling by police, issues such as traditional racism, the fact that 20% of the white population still admits to racial views and so on. These are common interests. But they pale in comparison. Well, they are very important, let me emphasize that, but they are not the same as what may be called group-specific problems, which are certainly acute, but are not necessarily due to race, which are very Afro-American, such as the problems of ghettoization and high sort of unemployment among youth and so on.
And are these the errors that are being made, as you say?
The errors are being, that are being made is that all the problems are being racialized, which is why Hillary Clinton got into the problem she got into. She's assuming that Al Sharpton represents Afro-Americans when, in fact, he represents one constituency. And I think it's insulting to Afro-Americans generally, and it's a distortion of the political process for her to be. She should not, the First Lady should not have been up there with this charlatan, this anti-Semite, this crook. What is she doing there? He represents perhaps one section of the Afro-American population, but certainly not mainstream Afro-Americans. But it's this standard means 20th century approach to the Afro-Americans as a homogeneous group. So you find the leader. So Al Sharpton is prominent. So you go and, and
there is
share
no,
the podium with him.
There is no one symbol. There is, as you say, the larger context. The questions revolving around how to improve the individual's everyday life.
The fundamental problem, the major problem right now in among Afro-Americans have to do with the persisting problems of poverty and unemployment among youth and the dreadful situation in their educational performance. It's the high dropout rates and their failure to perform education, which accounts for the fact that they're falling behind. These are the critical issues. You don't sit with Al Sharpton to discuss these. You sit with Al Sharpton if you want to discuss specific problems of race. But that's only one section of the kind of problems. Problems of inequality and poverty, Sharpton has little to say about. And I just think that this is what disturbs me about the conversation, so to speak. It's not a conversation. It's simply a replay of old 20th century approaches.
Pick a candidate who said things that disturb you the most so far in this campaign.
Well, I don't know if I want to do that in the sense that they've been very careful not to. The thing which has disturbed me most is Hillary's association with Sharpton, because I think Sharpton is evil and is bad for the Afro-American. They need him like they need a hole in the head. I mean, I think it's horrendous that Sharpton is the best that New York Afro-Americans can come up with as a leader. I mean, any group of people who can sort of end up with this creep as its leader is in deep trouble. And, you know, I think there's a problem, matter of principle here. People keep saying, well, 20% voted for him of Afro-Americans in the Senate bid. The problem is, so what? You have principles. And this man is a crook and a liar and a fraud who's never apologized for sort of hoodwinking the state of New York.
Let's move the campaign a little bit here. What do you want the conversation to be? What do you want the candidates to be talking about, to be focusing on?
I want him to be focusing on both, essentially, first of all, the problems that I call group-specific problems. By that I mean problems which are peculiar to Afro-Americans, even though they're not necessarily racial problems. These have to do with the high level of ghettoization of the group. It's an astonishing fact that Afro-Americans are now more ghettoized than they were 30, 40 years ago. And that, in turn, presents all sorts of problems. They are separate from where jobs are. They are separated from the broader community. Secondly, the enormous educational problems of the group. I mean, you know, this is the single most important factor explaining the growth of poverty or the persistence of poverty among them. So I want to talk about this. However, and this is the big issue which none of them have addressed, there are problems which are due to external factors, you know, a continuing discrimination, if you like, but there are problems which come from within the group itself. I'd like someone to be courageous enough to say, well, you know, this is what the state has to do, but this is what you have to do. What are you going to do about the high rate of paternal abandonment, the fact that 60% of Afro-American kids are growing up without the support of their fathers? What are you going to do about the fact that you're not performing educationally? And challenge the leadership to come up with some solution. I'd like to hear a leader who has the courage to urge Afro-Americans to in a sense, sort of view their problems as a partnership in the solution. That is that the state has this role to play, and Afro-Americans will have their role to play. And I don't hear that kind of discussion. What I hear is the old assumption that the problems are all due to racism, which in fact is only partly correct.
Should this conversation be framed in this way? The Washington Post wrote last month, it was written in the Washington Post, that the traditional focus of campaigns, of politicians, is on what it called grievance politics, righting the wrongs of history through programs such as affirmative action. Instead of the politicians adopting what the Democratic Leadership Council described, the politics of aspiration, pursuing policies promoting better jobs, better education, right, safer streets, the American dream for all, so to speak.
That's correct, except that I would also emphasize what I call group-specific issues. That is, the issues which are peculiar to Afro-Americans. And these are not necessarily race issues. You see, I mean, it's hard to separate them, because when you mention Afro-Americans to politicians or even to most journalists, what they think of is race. And this basically obscures the central issues. I mean, the problems of the ghettoization of the Afro-American population. Have you heard anyone addressing that issue? You know why? I mean, in many respects, many Afro-American leadership are skeptical about addressing that particular issue. It sort of sees
why
it dilutes the constituency. If for a politician, it's better to have Afro-Americans concentrated in urban sectors. And many people are very skeptical about what an increasing number of us think may be a major way in which you could reduce the problems of Afro-Americans, which is to get them out of the ghettos.
And isn't that why Americans are afraid to talk about that issue?
They're afraid to talk about many important issues. They're also afraid to talk about what is at the heart of the educational crisis among Afro-Americans. Now, the schools are often mentioned as one factor. I know we have lousy schools, and that's got to be addressed. But ask any educational sociologist now, and they'll tell you that the problems are not just schools. The problems have to do with what goes on in the communities from which Afro-American and Latino kids are coming. No one addresses that that question. You know, Bradley, in the debate the other night, made an interesting remark. He said that it's everybody wants to change the world, but nobody wants to change themselves. I thought that was a poignant remark, and I thought it would be interesting if he could address that to Afro-Americans, to Latinas, and other groups who he sees as his natural supporters, and really get into a conversation of not only how can the state change things for you, which is important, but also how can we think about how you can change yourself? Because that is just as important if Afro-Americans are going to catch up.
Connection listeners, where is the dialogue on race for you? 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Let's bring another voice to the connection this morning. Eleanor Holmes Norton, Congresswoman for the District of Columbia, advisor to the Gore campaign. Thanks for being on the connection.
Good morning.
Tell us where you think the dialogue is and where you think it should be.
Well, inevitably in a presidential campaign, perhaps regrettably, the dialogue is on whatever the issues of the day are. So, for example, the press will push the candidates on an issue that is of little moment in the scheme of things to black people, and that is what flag should fly over the capital of South Carolina. It has enormous symbolic importance, but it will not put food in the mouth of a single poor child, nor go anywhere toward improving schools. But it's a campaign issue. Campaigns distort our discussion of race because necessarily campaigns are not interested in long-term issues like how to improve how to close the gap between blacks and whites.
Why?
In this country.
Why?
The campaigns are because campaigns are driven by the press, and the press is driven by the issues of the moment. That is why. Now, the candidates themselves do issue papers and try to inject larger issues into it, but campaigns are not driven by the candidates. They are driven by the issues that the press presses upon them.
I agree with that, Ellen. I think you're absolutely right. Because, you know, Bradley and Gore, too, have issued some very interesting statements about how they'll address the problems of the poor and of Afro-Americans in particular. One of them, which interests me very much, is tremendous more money spent on early education, even before kindergarten. I think there's a lot of studies have indicated that this makes a difference. And Bradley and Gore have both come out in support of early full-time pre-kindergarten education. Does the press pick up on this? Absolutely not. I mean, so you're right. To some extent, they're trapped with the way in which it's defined. But, you know, I think if they had, I don't think one can blame the press entirely for this. I mean, I think if Bradley is as thoughtful a person as he claims to be, I think they should keep pressing it and keep insisting that these are the issues which they want to talk about.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right. And you know, when Gore says, for example, that he wants universal preschool education for every child, if you were to ask me what could make the greatest difference to black people, I would say it is that. If a child, for example, doesn't learn to read in these very early years when the brain is in formation, as it were, it's almost impossible to learn when you get to be 9 or 10 years old, and so you give up. So, you know, it is true that there are very deep issues, and since blacks are disproportionately affected by many of the issues that the candidates raise, we need to hone in on those issues and try to move the press and, yes, the candidates, so that their discussions of those issues can take place. I mean, look what the president tried to do. Clinton had a whole commission on race to try to get people to think about race, think about themselves and race, and what they should be doing, as well as what the country should be doing. And, you know, it was a yawn as far as the press was concerned. It was hard to formulate it in a way that caught everybody's interest in a world in which everybody wants something as exciting as a basketball shot.
No, I have to jump in, I guess, as the journalist among the three of us, and say, but whose responsibility is it? I mean, isn't it the candidates and isn't it the politicians' responsibility to motivate the public? I mean, the journalists, the newspapers, the TVs, the radios, we're only the instrument to deliver the message. We're not the message itself. Although some would argue that.
Well,
some would argue that.
You frame the questions as well. No, it is not. Look, I'm not one of these folks who think that the press is the bane of our existence. But I do think that the candidates have an enormous responsibility. I happen to think that both of these candidates, Gore and Bradley, have paid a lot of attention to race and have been very thoughtful about race. But when you ask why isn't more of that getting out, I don't think it's because the candidates have
To some extent, too. I mean, Afro-American leadership is to be blamed. I mean, we blame the press. We said the candidates should be more articulate in these views. But to repeat a point I made earlier, isn't it sad that in the great state of New York, in which Afro-Americans have had such a glorious history, that Al Sharpton is seen by Mrs. Clinton as someone she has to associate with because he represents the sort of the main leadership of that group? What's going on among Afro-American leadership? Where are the other people who should be sort of, you know, blowing Sharpton off the stage because they're there? I mean, that's I think, as much of a failure as the failure of the press to pick up on the issues, as well as the politicians to articulate more seriously.
Well, Sharpton, it's interesting that you name Al Sharpton. Al Sharpton is a press-made political figure.
Exactly.
I mean, he certainly isn't an elected official. He's a very articulate guy who knew how to get the press. And then let me tell you that the politicians and the public officials, once you get that kind of attention and then you run for office and you get a healthy amount of votes, again, because people vote for people often whose names they know and who they see standing up for them, even if even if they're standing up for them in ways that are not always commendable, then somehow you get to be a leader.
You see,
I come out of the civil rights movement where when you got to be a leader, you had to be Martin Luther King or Floyd Wilkins, or you had to be Malcolm X. You had to stand for something.
And I've always thought that when politicians and then the media focus on folks like Al Sharpton, or when we focus on issues such as the Confederate flag flying over the Capitol in South Carolina, that what we're engaging in is escapism. We're focusing on something that allows the candidates to talk about anything other than the important issues of the day, which should be discussed.
I think that's a profound point.
I think
the press, both the printed media and the television, are moved by images. Now, the flag is an extraordinary image. So if you want to talk about something that does your work for you, because the image is bigger than life, then you can talk about the Confederate flag.
1-800.
To talk about what's going to happen to black people. You gotta get into words and ideas, and that's more difficult to get across. And the press doesn't do that well, and if I may say so, as a politician, we often don't do that very well either.
It's kind of tough, or interesting, I should say, to hear you admit that when you're working for Al Gore.
Why is there anything inconsistent about that? Al Gore has a very long and distinguished record of in fact working for African Americans at great risk to himself. I mean, here is a politician who was a Southern representative in the body in which I serve, and a Southern senator, and in vote after vote cast votes for civil rights and for issues that blacks stand for. In many ways, against his own interests.
What we seem to be saying is that there's something wrong.
His own political interests.
There's something wrong with the process in which we elect leaders, in which people participate. I mean, one of the problems we have is that the mass of the electorate is in fact disengaged from the political process, and the only way in which we can engage them during this burst of activity during election times is to emphasize these highly symbolic issues, or to use humor. You know, the New York Times today, I was appalled to read that candidates are terrified by the late night comics because they feel that they have enormous power to define how people see them. I mean, what kind of electorate is that? I mean, the comics respond, Jay Leno and others, by saying that they're just reflecting what their audience sort of views. I mean, what kind of electorate is that, which, in a sense, is only engaged to the point where a comic can influence and reflect their views? I mean, so I think that there's something wrong with our democratic system here, and we've got to get some way of elevating the level of participation and concern and engagement of people in things that are vital for them in the political system, and we haven't.
Let's find out if our next guest agrees and can find the right formula for us. Michael Eric Dyson joins us now, professor of religious studies at DePaul University in Chicago. Michael Eric Dyson, are you hearing a conversation about race on the campaign trail this year, the conversation that you want to hear?
Well, of course not to the degree that I'd like to hear it, and certainly not to the depth of complexity that Professors Patterson and Congresswoman Norton have talked about. But I think that certainly in Al Gore, and at least certainly Bill Bradley, we've had the beginnings of a serious wrestling with this major dilemma of American society. If they're not getting into the entrails of the beast, at least they're trying to grab at its tail. So I think that's very important. Right, so I think it's very important to do that. But what's interesting to me about this, hello?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry, I hear some noise there. About the conversation on race in regard to, say, Al Sharpton, what's interesting is that I've just written a book on Martin Luther King Jr., and many of the claims that are made against Al Sharpton, that he's out, that King is outside the political process, that he's rather a more symbolic leader than a substantive leader, that the press made him, he's not a grassroots person, after all, he got a PhD from Boston University, he didn't come from, quote, among the people, those same arguments, and I'm not trying to suggest that Al Sharpton in any way compares to Martin Luther King Jr., but he does I think, speak to issues of importance to grassroots people by seizing the visibility of the press and using that, whether for good or ill, to make sure that those issues are spotlighted. For instance, the issue of police brutality. Al Sharpton was way ahead of the curve of that. So when the press finally came around to highlighting the intense arguments in black communities and the struggles between white and black Americans, at least over the issue of police brutality, he had already made a career out of focusing on that issue and forcing at least parts of the mainstream to acknowledge that. So when Hillary Clinton stops by Al Sharpton's National Action Network, it is a recognition of his work with Reverend Wyatt T. Walker in New York and Harlem, and his grassroots mobilizing and organizing within that community to make sure that the spotlight fell on that issue. So I think that some of the same issues that King was beat up on for, Sharpton has been beat up on for, and again, I think leadership seizes the opportunity where it can find itself and then goes forward to try to represent those issues. So I think that the race issue, in terms of the larger political process, of course, has never been as seriously attacked as it should be. Even President Clinton, I think, with his noble attempt to try to jumpstart the race conversation, hamstrung it by bringing some lethal perceptions to the table. Number one, that there was an equal dialogue going on between black and white Americans. I think many white Americans refuse to take the sincerity of responsibility that they want to hoist or foist upon African-American people. If you have been the recipients of the disproportionate resources of American society, you certainly have a moral obligation to be more self-critical in regard to the racial conversation. So I think that has to be dealt with as well.
Michael Eric Dyson, stay with us as you can as we move toward the break. We'd like to say thanks and goodbye to Congresswoman for the District of Columbia, advisor to Al Gore, Eleanor Holmes Norton. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com.
I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking about race in the campaign year 2000. Our guests are Michael Eric Dyson, professor of religious studies at DePaul University in Chicago. He's joining us on the line. And here in the studio, Orlando Patterson, professor of sociology at Harvard University. 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, what are the candidates missing in the talk about race in the campaign? And in some ways, do you think it's intentional disregard? Just before we went into the break, Michael Eric Dyson was talking about the symbol of mm-hmm. Al Sharpton in this mm-hmm. Campaign, and Professor Patterson, you wanted to respond.
Yeah, while I'm sympathetic to a lot of what Michael had to say, I mean, I do sort of take some exception to the comparison between the way in which Sharpton emerged and the way in which Martin Luther King emerged. I mean, King did not emerge into the spotlight as a result of a shaman of fraud, and he emerged in the spotlight by risking his life and his neck with support for a noble cause. What concerns me here is about Sharpton is the fact that is the way in which he has emerged as a leader. You're absolutely right. I mean, he sort of represented these dramatically represented the interests of Afro-Americans in these high-profile incidents. But the question I have to ask is this the way in which we promote leaders? Is this the way in which Afro-American leadership is to emerge in the 21st century? There was a time when this kind of highly symbolic grassroots type of activity made sense when we're trying to promote a mass movement and so on. But I'm afraid this is the 21st century, and we live in a post-industrial society, and the interests of Afro-Americans are extremely varied. And it saddens me to think that this still remains the way in which leadership emerge, and this is the kind of con man you get in if this is the way in which the leadership of Afro-Americans are to be come to a position of prominence.
Professor Dyson, go ahead.
Yeah, I think Professor Patterson is making some brilliant points as usual, but I think I would dissent here. I think that he's absolutely right in terms of how King emerged. There's no question that he sacrificed himself for a noble cause, and as a result of that was thrust forward into the movement, what he called the battering rams of historical necessity. But I think the reality is that Al Sharpton Sue was produced by the times in which he lived. The times that produced Martin Luther King Jr. could no longer produce Martin Luther King Jr. now. So 21st century realities are absolutely different from 20th century realities of even 40 to 50 years ago, certainly when King emerged. Martin Luther King Jr. couldn't be Martin Luther King Jr. right now. These are extraordinarily different times. That is not to suggest that there's no moral or ethical difference between Martin Luther King Jr. and Al Sharpton, but I think at the same time that the press played an incredibly important role in giving a spotlight to a figure like King. And I'll tell you, I argue that because precisely when that spotlight was shunning Martin Luther King Jr. at the end of his life, when King became much more radical, when he became much more insistent on aggressive nonviolence, Time Magazine, Newsweek Magazine, and even U.S. News and World Report, along with New York Times and Washington Post and many other papers, began to cast aspersions against King, began to say that he was not a moral figure, that he was a charlatan. Everything that is said about Al Sharpton right now was said about King, especially near the end of his life. Now that the sweet scent of martyrdom has blown through his life, we've erased these contradictions. However, I think that Professor Patterson is absolutely right, that you do see, I think, an evolution in Al Sharpton, however. In other words, I think some of the questionable things he did early in his career that were explicitly, I think, problematic and certainly contrary to the kind of moral stature he enjoys now, has to be acknowledged. I think, however, Al Sharpton is not the Al Sharpton of 10 years ago. I think Al Sharpton has matured and grown and at least been confronted with the realities that political leadership is about more than becoming a mouthpiece for a particular cause in the media. So I think that we have to acknowledge that kind of complexity.
Sure,
as well.
But Michael, where are the other leaders? I mean, there are 35 million Afro-Americans. I mean, we're larger than most member nations of the United Nations. And I mean, one would have thought that there is a wide range of interests to be represented. Where are they?
Well, I agree with you, Orlando. I think that there's no question that your point about the diversity of black people means that we have a diversity of black leaders. And there are other black leaders. I just shared a podium with Maxine Waters out in California. And she, to me, is one of the most brilliant, prophetic, insightful, helpful leaders in this country who happens to be an elected official. I happen to think when I look at young people, and I think Orlando may disagree with me here, when I look among the young so-called hip-hop generation, I see many activists on a local level. I'm here in Chicago, so I see Barack Obama, who's now challenging Bobby Rush for a seat in Congress. I see Jesse Jackson Jr. I see Harold Ford. But I also see a range of other figures who are emerging, not only within black political elites, but also in terms of grassroots organizing. Makani Temba, who's just written a book about organizing for African-American and other progressive causes. So there are a whole range of people who don't receive the kind of media play that Al Sharpton receives. And furthermore, when I think about young rappers like, say, Mos Def, who's a Brooklyn-reared hip-hopper who co-owns a bookstore called Nkuru Books in Brooklyn, who is about bringing serious political consciousness to young African-American people, but who's also concerned about raising the stakes for the expression and articulation of rage within artistic media. So there are a whole range of people who are out there doing their thing, who don't get on the shows, talk shows during the week, but who are nonetheless doing significant work that's serious, that's concentrated, that means a big deal to the people who receive their leadership.
Michael Eric Dyson, as I look at the clock, I know you have to go at this moment. Thank you very much for joining The Connection today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be on here with you, Professor Patterson, and Congresswoman Norton.
Michael Eric Dyson is professor of religious studies at DePaul University in Chicago. 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Let's find out what Connection listeners are thinking about and talking about in relation to the discussion about race in the year 2000 presidential campaign. William, you're on the Connection. Hi.
Yes, good morning. Very, very important topic. I enjoy it. Listen, I want to first of all agree with Brother Tyson, and that is, deflect my main point. The thing is that people like Al Sharpton and other activists, not leaders, activists are essential in the civil rights, human rights, economic, political, and religious rights of this country for all people. Now, historically speaking, we've always had a variety of activists and leaders. This is important to the movement. Stokely Carmichael, Rap Brown, Martin Luther King, E.D. Nixon, the list goes on and on and on and on. You don't sit in ivory towers and point fingers at so-called community leaders and cast them as charlatans. This is not productive for the cause. That's my main point. Now, secondly, let me say this. In terms of the political discussion today, all these politicians pander, and I do say pander, for constituencies. That's what's taking place now. That's what happens when you're talking about something as important as race. Now, you take the president's commission on race. That commission was sidetracked and sabotaged by the likes of people like Abigail Bernstrom. Brought the discussion in terms of affirmative action and all those other off issues and got the topic sidetracked and put aside. So the likes of people like John Hope Franklin were rendered ineffective. That's what the problem is. People have too many different causes when it comes to race that they're trying to perpetrate on the whole topic of race.
What should the commission have been focusing on?
The commission, basically, from a presidential point of view, only focused on one thing, and that is setting the moral tone, admitting that there is a problem. The work has to be done in the communities. That's why people like Al Sharpton and other activists are important in activating and agitating and getting people involved. That's the meaning of activism. See, your guest keeps talking about leadership. That's an outdated old concept. You're talking 60s. We're not looking for leaders now. We're looking for activists. That's what took place up in Seattle with the WTO conference this past year.
I thought the reverse is true. We always need leaders, my friend. Whatever the arena of life, whether it's in business or politics or education, we always need leaders. There are times when we need activists, and I agree with you that activists are a critical part of social movement. However, we've got to draw the line someplace at some point, and principles must apply. There are activists and there are activists. None of the activists from the 60s you mentioned began their career with a fraud. And I mean, this man is perpetrated a hoax on the state of New York and has never apologized for it, and is a charlatan. I mean, there, you've got to draw the line some point. In the 1930s, there was an activist, a very prominent activist, who articulated the problems of Germans very well, and had 20% of the vote, and he was taken very seriously, and his name was Hitler. I mean, if someone at some point had said, look, this man is a charlatan, which everyone knew he was, and that you draw the line, we may not have had the consequences of his rise to power. At some point, you've got to distinguish between activists who really do promote movement and activists who, because of their past, because of their character, because of the people we know they are just frauds.
William, thank you for your call. Let's bring another voice to the connection now. Roger Wilkins joins us. He's professor of history at George Mason University. He's also a Bradley supporter. Roger Wilkins, does Bill Bradley have the ability to attract voters away from Al Gore? And is Bradley the kind of leader that some people are saying is needed in this campaign?
Well, he obviously can draw voters away from Al Gore. A year ago, people thought Gore was a shoo-in, and now he's in a fight. And the reason he's in a fight is that Bradley showed himself to voters, and there were enough people who thought that he was attractive and had attractive things to say, who pulled away from Gore to make this a fight. So sure, he can certainly draw voters away from Gore. Does he have things to say? I think so. I despite Gore's attacks, I think that the Bradley approach to health care is a good one. I think his approach to child poverty is a good one. And on race, my judgment is that you really have to look behind what people say and to what they know and to what they are. When I was a young man in the Kennedy administration and later in the Johnson administration, I watched John Kennedy have to be educated about race and watched him move very reluctantly into the arena while blacks and their civil rights allies did all kinds of things to make him understand the depth of the problem. Then, amazingly, against my own skepticism about this Texas Southerner, I watched Lyndon Johnson leap into the issue and become what many of us believe was the best president on race that the country has ever had. And the difference between the two guys was their guts.
At one campaign forum, Bill Bradley said that there's been progress in race relations, but that racism still exists subtly. It's not a question of whether a Latino can buy a meal in a restaurant now. It's a question of whether he or she can get the loan to buy the restaurant. Is that where the debate should be?
That's a large part of it. But I think it's not as subtle as Senator Bradley says. Yes, there is a huge problem about capital. Yes, there is a huge problem about whether blacks can and Latinos can be have the opportunities to own and operate businesses. But for the black community, there is this looming problem. We've had full employment, close to full employment, this huge economy, and still huge numbers of blacks are left way, way behind. And I think we're...
And so what will Bill Bradley do about that?
Well, I can't tell you exactly what he'll do because I'm not making his programs, but he obviously is going to work hard on education. He is obviously going to try to eliminate child poverty. And I would assume that were he president and it were brought to him that you really needed some kind of employment program to make opportunity work for poor people, that he will do that. The fact is that he is connected in a very fundamental way to the problems of poor people and minority people because he worked with them for a long time on an intimate basis. And I trust his instincts. I trust him profoundly.
It can be argued that on the Republican side, George W. Bush is talking about the future instead of the past. He's pushing as part of his campaign the fact that there needs to be opportunity for all. There needs to be better education for all. The streets need to be safer for all. Is George W. Bush going to gain a certain advantage here, Professor Patterson?
No. He talks a good talk, but there are one or two issues in which Bush is simply unacceptable to Afro-Americans, and one of them has to do with an issue we haven't raised before, which is crime. It's all Afro-Americans want, because they disproportionately suffer, want to have effective crime programs and to get guns off the street, which Bush seems opposed to. But more important, one critical factor, the absurdly and obscenely high rate of incarceration of Afro-Americans in prison. Now, this is due partly to the fact that Afro-Americans commit a higher proportion of crime, but a good part of the fact that 40% of the incarcerated population are Afro-American men has to do with extremely unfair laws and sentencing procedures, which I want to hear at least one of the leaders have the courage to say something about. I mean, because we've given up on rehabilitation, and in fact, what we're doing is utterly counterproductive in the sense that we're simply creating criminals in the process of simply throwing people in prison for committing nonviolent crimes and these long sentences in which judges have no discretion over. Now, George Bush is just a Neanderthal as far as the criminal system goes. And I mean, that's why, and I don't see him in fact gaining much in Afro-American votes in that respect. I don't hear much, however, from either Bradley or Gore on this issue.
Professor Wilkins, let me ask you a specific question. Let me ask you the question that I think kind of gets to the heart of this. If Bill Bradley called you this morning and said, Professor Wilkins, I'm contemplating where that intersection where law and order and race meet, where should I be? What would you say to him?
First of all, I'd say to you that Orlando is right about Bush, but he doesn't go far enough. And that is that Bush has presided over more executions in Texas.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
He's the champion of executions, and most of those executions are of black people. The second is that his tax program would his tax cut program would wipe out any possibility of using this newfound national wealth to help poor people. So he's off the table immediately. if Bradley came to talk to me, I would say, look, there are no magic bullets, but we need to worry about the destruction of our kids. And the intersection that needs to be met is jobs for parents, health for children from the time they're born, and really decent education. Educational equity in this country is an absolute fraud. The poorest kids in this society are getting chewed up in schools that are disabling them from participation in the society which they're going to face. So I would say health, employment, and education with a view to creating young minority kids who can participate in the opportunities that this new economy is creating.
I noticed that almost absent in our discussion of the last 50 minutes or so has been the phrase affirmative action.
Well, I tell you, I think affirmative action has worked wonderfully well in this society, and it's been given an awful bad name. I love the University of Michigan, where I went for 7 years and got 2 degrees and 1 wife. But the University of Michigan that I went to in the late 40s and mid-50s, I never was assigned a book, a poem, a play, or an essay by a black person. I never had a black or a female professor. I never had an assignment that told me that black people had done anything useful in the history of the world except for Brown v. Board of Education, which I studied in law school and constitutional law. The University of Michigan that young people attend now, that my young nephew attends right now, is such a far better institution than the one I attended. It is breathtaking. The faculty is diverse. The student body is far more diverse. The curriculum is diverse. Now, does that benefit only blacks and women? Heck no. The university is far better for every student who attends because of its diversity in all respects. And it's better for the country, because the country that my nephew is graduating into is a far more diverse country than we lived in, and is going to be still more diverse. And one of the main things that Americans have to learn to do is to live with each other and to value difference and to understand difference and to work with difference. You
actually
have to have diverse universities for that.
Actually, this is an interesting question, because compared with the last presidential election, where it was at the top of the list of contentious issues, I think one of the reasons that there's almost no difference between Bradley and Gore on this issue, and also, interestingly, I think Bush somewhat favors it, because what's emerging in the South, in Texas in particular, is a subtle, sometimes not so subtle, rejection of the initiative by conservative Republicans to undo affirmative action. It's significant that Houston, for example, voted in favor of affirmative action. And recently, the Texas legislature, in effect, sort of sidestepped the anti-affirmative action law by its ruling that the top 10% of all schools can go to any college. And so my sense is that all the three candidates here basically have put this on the back burner.
And Professor Wilkins, do you think that we'll hear more about affirmative action as we wind toward the November general election, or less?
Well, I can't, I don't know, but I, Orlando, I think, is more sanguine about Bush on this than I am. He's in a state where the Hopwood decision made affirmative action unconstitutional, and he's been courting the, assiduously courting the Latino vote, so he had to do something so that Latinos wouldn't be shut out of the three higher educational systems there. But if you look at the fact that he's ducking the South Carolina flag issue, which is about as easy as you get, it means that the Republican Party is still addicted to the idea of presenting itself as a largely white party.
Roger Wilkins, thank you so much. Roger Wilkins is an advisor to the Bill Bradley campaign. Orlando Patterson is professor of sociology at Harvard University, joining us earlier this hour. Michael Eric Dyson and Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Christopher Lydon. Thanks all to the Connection listeners who called this hour. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
Cassettes of The Connection are available for $15, including shipping and handling. To order, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Alaya Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Barnes & Noble at Boston University, where authors Persis Karim and Mohammed Karami will discuss and sign their